Good morning. Well, it's great to have you guys here on episode 10 of What? Trying to go over some of the major themes for me of what I would like our confirmands to know about. And not just be about memorizing creeds or being able to spit back certain doctrines or dogmas, but to really kind of get at the core of what it means to be a follower of Jesus in the 21st century. And I think that it's different than what I think a lot of us grew up with. And so one of the reasons that I'm doing this story today is because it's a story that I think many of us feel like we're familiar with if we've been around church at all. We kind of, you know, think we know what it talks about. But I want to revisit a little bit with some background information you might not know about. And so if you have your Bibles and want to turn to Luke, we're going to be looking at chapter 13. And before Beth reads that to us, I just want to give you a little background. The first thing I want to tell you is to watch out for three characters. How many characters?
Three.
Three characters. The first one, Jesus. Okay, what could be better? He's in a synagogue, right? And this is not unusual. Leading up to this particular story, there have been episodes where Luke is trying to portray his authority being amped up a little bit. He's getting a little upgrade each one of the stories that comes along. First, he's shown having authority over unclean spirits. Then he has to argue about whether it's a right thing or not to do good on the Sabbath to save a life. And then here in our story, it's clear that his concern is about the suffering of a fellow human being and that taking precedent over the rules that a lot of people would want to impose on him. Okay, so our first character,
Jesus.
Second character, the woman. Okay, now let me just tell you. Do I have to say anything more that you add a woman to the story? And there's tension, right? And in this first century situation, women were not allowed in the synagogue, okay? This was a guy thing. And women had their place, but it was not in the body of the synagogue. And so we have a woman who was where she was not supposed to be, okay? So there's tension. First character,
Jesus.
Second character,
the woman.
Third character, the synagogue leader. Now, this person is a really interesting character. He is kind of a set up as the defender of the status quo. He doesn't want any trouble, okay? Will you just go with the rules, all right? No variation, please, from the rules. And if you think of the time that this was written, post-70, in 70, the Romans came in, they wiped out the temple, knocked it down flat, and so Judaism, as a faith tradition, no longer had a center of worship. All of the practice of Judaism was transferred out into the countryside, into little synagogues, which is just another word for gathering. Okay, that's all that synagogue means. And in fact, in this day and age, there were no buildings that were dedicated to Judaism. I mean, you didn't have a synagogue that people came to. What you did is you had somebody in town who maybe had a big courtyard, and you all gathered in the courtyard. Or you had somebody that had a big enough room to fit the necessary number of people. And so there were no formal buildings used. So you need to get into your mind when you hear this story that it was outside in a courtyard or maybe in a room out somewhere in the countryside. And this leader, if you'll notice in the passage, is not called a rabbi. He's not a rabbi, not a priest. He's just the synagogue leader. And so maybe he is like modern day synagogues. Maybe he is elected as president of the synagogue for the year, right? Now, if you've been elected president for the year, you want to make sure that everybody gets what they want, right? And so you don't want anybody coming in and messing up the rules because it might upset some people and you might not get reelected, right? So the last thing you want is somebody coming up here messing up your comfortable way of doing things. Another way to look at it is that the leader of the synagogue might be the owner of the house, right? I mean, maybe they are rich enough that they own a big house where everybody can gather for synagogue. And if that's the case, maybe they are rich enough that they are used to people doing what they say to do and do it now, right? They're used to that kind of authority. And so they don't like people coming in and doing things that are not the way they've set it up. And so you've got Jesus, you've got the woman, and you've got the synagogue leader whose major need is to maintain order. And all of a sudden, you got this crazy guy, Jesus, breaking all the rules.
From Luke. Now Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment." When he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites! Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" When he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things that he was doing. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, we're thankful for these words of wisdom from so long ago. We ask that your Spirit would be upon us, that we might hear them for our lives for today. For we gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. A few years ago, all of the clergy, the United Methodist pastors from the Arizona area and Southern Nevada got together for a pastor's school. And at that pastor's school, there was a lot of talk about self-care and how we needed to improve on the way we take care of ourselves. But it was really difficult because while we were being encouraged to be mindful of the present moment, a very Buddhist kind of idea, it was virtually impossible for all of us to do that. Because each of us were busy, you know, we were at this conference and we were worrying about the stuff we weren't getting done that was coming up this weekend, blah, blah, blah. Or we were thinking about what we didn't get done before we left. And everybody was busy either fretting about what might or might not happen in the future and looking back and thinking about the stuff that we hadn't got done or maybe the stuff we regretted doing in the past. And we never were really paying attention to anything other than the future and the past. It's always about me, really. We never really were paying attention to the other. So we are so busy, I think, as human beings, anxious about stuff that might happen, or worried about stuff that we've done in the past, that we seldom have time to really pay attention to right here and right now, which is really the only place that we can actually be engaged with other human beings and with the Spirit. And one of my spiritual directors told a story once that takes off from one of the images of Genesis, where it places God as kind of the CEO in a great cosmic boardroom. And one of his board members is Ha-Satan. And Ha-Satan comes to God, and God is gloating and saying, "Look at this beautiful creation. It's so wonderful. And the pinnacle of all this creation is, look at these human beings. Aren't they fantastic? Look at how cute they are. They're wonderful. They're beautiful. They're so talented. And they love me. They love me. Look at how they love me." And Ha-Satan says, "Well, wouldn't anybody love you if all you did was give them stuff? I mean, that's all you do is you just have given them everything they could possibly want. They're in the garden. Everything is just fine. But if you take something away from them, watch how quick they turn on you." And God was like, "Okay, I'll take that challenge, but give me a few minutes to think about it." And so everybody came back the next day, and God sat down, and everybody was anticipating this great solution to this problem. And God said, well, what I've decided to do is bless these human beings with an ability that none of the other animals in my creation are able to do. I am going to bless human beings with the ability to dream of what might be, to look into the future and plan for what could be and how we might be able to do things together for the glory of God and creation. And I'm also going to give them the ability to remember, to think back about all of the beautiful things in life that nurture us and keep us going, about the love that we've experienced from loved ones who may be gone now, but that we can always look back on and appreciate. And God sat back. It's done. And Ha-Satan got up and said, now wait just one moment here. You're supposed to curse them. You're not just supposed to bless them. You cannot just bless them. That was the whole point of this exercise. You need to curse them as well to make sure that they're going to love you despite being cursed. So you need to curse them. And God said, I have. Because like no other creature, human beings are able to look into the future and not just dream, but fret. And human beings are able to look into the past and not just remember, but become almost comatose with regret over what has been done or maybe what has not been done. The ability to both remember and plan into the future is both a blessing and a curse. And I think that the secret of a balanced and whole life finally comes down to the ability for any of us to pay attention to the here and now. Because isn't that the only place where you can actually experience the presence of the Spirit or a relationship with another human being? Is with the person right in front of you, with the moment that you are experiencing right now. But because we're always worried about the consequences or of what we might or might not find the next hour ahead of us, or maybe we're full of regret about the past, we make a lot of rules. Rules are there to try and control all of these potential what-ifs and to make it so that we don't have to regret the past. And the church is one of the first among all the rule makers, with the added bonus that the church's rules are somehow holy, right? They have the added bonus of eternal consequences, right? If you don't follow the church's rules. Well, one time when I was visiting Jerusalem, I had a professor who took some time living at a yeshiva in order to kind of get a feel for what the Orthodox community was like, what it was like to live in an Orthodox community. And it's clear if you go into any of these neighborhoods in Jerusalem and in some of the big cities here in the United States that you're in an Orthodox neighborhood because there are some things that you don't find just about anywhere else. One is a Shabbat elevator, okay? Now, these are everywhere now in Jerusalem. And a lot of places in New York, Chicago, etc. Now, the deal is that if you press the button on an elevator, right, you are doing something, you're opening a circuit, right, that is considered work, okay? And you're not allowed to do work on the Sabbath, right? So a Shabbat elevator is pre-programmed so that it stops on every floor, the door opens so people can get on and off, and the door closes, goes up to the next floor. The door opens, people get on and off, the door closes. It goes all the way up, however high it is, God help you if you're on the 40th floor, and then it comes down again. And usually, depending on just how Jewish the neighborhood is, Sometimes you're left with just one elevator that's a normal elevator. The rest are all doing this every floor thing. And you think, oh, well, you know, that's just in Jewish neighborhoods, that's in Israel, whatever. But you know what? There's a nod to Jewish sensibilities more places than you would know to these Orthodox ways of doing things. In fact, if you have a refrigerator, I would encourage you to look at it. Because if you've got a refrigerator that's built any time in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years or more, you'll see that there is humidity control, door alarm, and Sabbath mode. Check it out. I checked my refrigerator this morning. It's got one of those little panels. I had to scroll through the commands, and there it was, Sabbath mode. Okay? Now what? Yours does too?
Yeah, our stove.
Your stove has it.
Oh.
Exactly. You can, that is exactly right. You can set it with a timer, okay? And with a Sabbath mode refrigerator, what happens is when you open the door, the light doesn't come on and the compressor doesn't go on, okay? So you can get in and get your stuff and close the door quickly, all right? So that's what Sabbath mode is. Now, Dr. Fleming, my professor in Jerusalem, his job when he lived at the yeshiva was to tear off, this is Friday morning, right before Shabbat began, to tear off individual pieces of toilet paper and stack them next to every toilet. Because the Rebbe at that particular yeshiva had determined that tearing toilet paper was work, right? So that's something they had to take care of ahead of time, like setting up your oven ahead of time to come on without your involvement, right? So these are all extreme examples of people who are extremely orthodox in their practice. But just as an example, they are out there. That's what taking the rules to that kind of a level leads to. Now, I'm still a little aflutter because I had a chance to meet one of my heroes this week and spend time actually just hanging out with him and driving around, and it was amazing. His name is Bishop Gene Robinson. And 4 years ago, there was an event that happens once every 10 years. It's called the Lambeth Conference. It's in Canterbury in England. And every 10 years, every single bishop of the Anglican Communion, we're talking 1,000 bishops from all over the world, are invited to come to Canterbury for conferences and to figure out what the church is doing and yada, yada. 4 years ago at the 2008 Lambeth Conference, Gene Robinson was the one bishop out of over 1,000 that was specifically, personally uninvited. In fact, he was told by the Archbishop of Canterbury that he was not allowed to show up. He was forbidden to come. They even had pictures up in the security areas of him so that he could be excluded by security. So, why was Gene Robinson excluded? Because he is the first openly gay bishop in the Anglican Communion. Now, mind you, he is not the first gay bishop. You got it? He's the first honest gay bishop. And for that honesty, he has had all kinds of trouble. Because honesty is too much for some people to handle. When he was consecrated as bishop, he had to wear a bulletproof vest under his robes. He gets regular death threats from people. And not long ago, the police stopped a man who was on his way to Gene's house with a map of his house and everything and a loaded shotgun to kill him. And all of these threats are from good Christians convinced that Gene has broken the rules and needs to die. I mean, if you take Leviticus seriously, right? Now, whatever you might think of homosexuality, equality in marriage, you best just get used to it being the norm. The norm. Ask anyone who is following this issue and they know this battle is already done. It's already done, both civilly and in our churches. As many of you know, the United Methodist Church is one of the last holdouts of mainline Protestantism. The Episcopal Church, the UCC, the Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church, all accept lesbian and gay clergy and members in full connection, and two of them are already doing same-sex unions. The argument now is strictly over timing, right? Can we hold it off as long as we can, is basically the attitude of many people. But I'm telling you, 20 years from now, we will look back and we will see how excluding LGBT people from public life is as silly and as unjust as having excluded women from the vote, or having laws that make mixed race couples illegal, which only came off the books, not even 40 years ago. And both of these issues were issues that the church fought against tooth and nail. Tooth and nail. Now, we all can share stories of what seemed like silly to what are clearly awful things that the church does. Here's an example of one of Fred Phelps' grandchildren who goes around and protests at the funerals of Iraq and Afghanistan soldiers, because they believe that the Iraq and Iran war and that 9/11 were because the United States is not following the rules as they understand it. And so we get punished. And so that's what they do. That's what they do. And in our story today, Jesus models the norm for him, which is exactly the opposite of protecting the institution. Because Jesus put the dignity and the wholeness of that woman first. When Jesus replies to the leader of the synagogue, people must think he sounds crazy, because he's coming from such a different place than the leader in his understanding of the divine. And when questioned, Jesus answers, look, if it's right to care for a domestic animal on the Sabbath, then it's right to relieve human distress. His priority was the person right there in front of them. Now, Jesus' logic can have some holes poked in it, because watering animals on the Sabbath is a matter of survival, but the woman could live one more day. Come on, right? She's lived 18 years stooped over. And the leader of the synagogue basically saying, look, this is the Sabbath. Come back tomorrow, right? Don't bother me today. Come back tomorrow. But Jesus isn't trying to discredit the Sabbath. He's simply got his priorities in a different place. It's clear that what he says in the Mark version of this story, you might have heard the saying before, the Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. Here's the difference. Jesus' basic assumption is that God's intention in the law, wherever else we can find it, is focused on people's well-being. That's God's intention, is people's well-being. And that is diametrically opposed to the synagogue leader's understanding of God's intention of us following the commandments. You see how different those are? Behind one image is a God who says, I must be obeyed to prove your love for me. Now, naturally, in that case, you're going to want to know all the rules, right? And you're going to want to follow them very carefully. Our devotion is measured by how well we keep those rules. Now, I mean, think about the leader of the synagogue's position, okay? Jesus teaching in the synagogue. That's the good column, okay? Woman, bad column. Woman in the synagogue, extra bad column. Woman with an ailment, probably a sinner, bad, bad, bad. Jesus doing anything contrary to my understanding of the law, bad, bad, bad. So there are not too many things in the good column for this synagogue leader. The woman actually being healed is beside the point, because his concern is the rules are being broken. So Jesus' attitude doesn't deny that it's important for the sake of the community to have rules for the common good, right? We have understandings that help us live together. But Jesus' understanding of the divine is subtly different. For Jesus, God's chief concern is not to be obeyed, but to inspire love and care for all people and all creation. Commandments, rules, guidelines, traditions, laws, scriptures, they are all subordinate to that one purpose of love. Now remember when Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? He said, to love God with all your heart, your soul, your strength, and your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. You notice what he didn't say. Follow the rules. Right? This story is really a parody of Jesus' opponents. How absurd to object to someone being made well. How absurd to imagine that God would be more concerned about having the Sabbath protected than having this daughter of Abraham healed. What kind of God is that? Jesus spent much of his ministry trying to portray God in a different way than an aloof king demanding obedience. Or the stereotype from the opening story of a CEO in a boardroom kind of thing. Jesus portrayed the divine, think about the images he used, like a mother looking for a lost coin, or like a father who is running down the road to greet a lost son. I mean, the facades are dropped in favor of affection and of caring. If you expand this to a general principle, you've got one of the major components of a whole and balanced life, and that is put people first. Pay attention to who's right in front of you in the here and the now. Now, that's not easy, and it's really hard for some people to understand because we spend the vast majority of our lives worrying about the future, regretting the past, that we completely miss the people that are right in front of us and the power and depth of the possible relationships that we can have with one another. Now, it doesn't seem too far-fetched to say that the primary characteristic of a disciple of Jesus is in their expression of life, in putting the dignity of other people first in their lives, even if it's against the rules. And so I want to leave you with a stream of thought for today, which is put the dignity and wholeness of people first, and everything else will balance out. Everything else. Now, for some of you, this is new information, and it's uncomfortable. If religion is not about following the rules, then what's the point? All you have to do is look at Jesus. His ministry, in large part, was about confronting the rules that kept people from seeing the dignity and wholeness of every other human being. You know, when we're children, we have strict rules imposed on us, mainly to keep us from hurting ourselves and others, right? But as we grow up, we see that there are exceptions to most rules, yes? And in fact, there are broader, more universal principles that govern our lives that we simply would not have understood when we were children. The story of Jesus is calling us to a very simple but very difficult task, and that's to respond with compassion to the needs of people around us, even if it means breaking the rules. Put people first. Off in the hills, there was an isolated monastery, and it was known for its strict rules, especially around the treatment of women. Don't talk to them, don't relate to them, don't dare touch them. One day, a couple of the monks took a hike into the nearest village to get supplies. And on their way back, they came to a stream that was swollen by rainfall. And there was a young woman there who was kind of hesitating, trying to get across the rapidly flowing stream. And without missing a beat, without hesitating, one of the monks went right up and picked her up and just waded right in and carried her right across the creek. Well, his companion was absolutely flabbergasted. He could not believe it. In fact, for the whole next 2 hours, he was just walking along, you know, just steamed. Like, how could you have done something like that? It was just total silence. He was just really irritated. Well, when they finally get back to the monastery, they get to the gate, and the one monk says to his companion, "So what is it that you're upset about?" And his friend said, You know the rules. You know that we're not supposed to connect, relate women, let alone pick them up, let them touch them. I mean, you touch that woman and... And his friend said, "Why are you still carrying that young woman? I put her down 2 hours ago." Don't get caught up thinking that following the rules is going to get God to love you or make you content with your life. They're just means to an end. And sometimes they're a barrier. They're a barrier to achieving the very thing that they're meant to accomplish. So pay attention to the Spirit moving. Pay attention to the person and the situation right in front of you, right here, right now. And when we are able to put the dignity and wholeness of people first, everything else will balance out. Amen.